From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. The Iran-Iraq War helped Saddam Hussein expand his power in the Middle East. On today's Fresh Air, we discuss the Gulf Crisis with journalist Dilip Hero. His new book is a history of the Iran-Iraq War. Also today, filmmaker Charles Burnett talks with us about the South, superstition, and his new movie, To Sleep With Anger. Rock historian Ed Ward continues his profile of soul star Curtis Mayfield. And Maureen Corrigan reviews a new book that looks at relations between the classes and the sexes as portrayed in Hollywood comedies of the 30s. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. U.S. officials said today that Israel has rejected an appeal from President Bush to cooperate with the United Nations investigation. The president made the appeal today in a letter to Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir. The Israeli rejection could prompt another U.S. vote against the Jewish state in the U.N. Security Council. The council is considering a resolution deploring Israel's refusal to allow a probe into the slaying of 21 Palestinians in East Jerusalem. There appears to have been a real breakthrough in the budget impasse on Capitol Hill. House Democrats have all but agreed to support a new compromise plan. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
This latest compromise appears to solve the one last dispute in the negotiations between the House, the Senate, and the White House. It would raise the top tax rate to 31%, but it would phase out the personal exemptions for taxpayers making $100,000 and more, and it would limit the amount of itemized deductions they can claim by 3%. The Democratic leadership in the House stressed that this would have the same effect in terms of getting the wealthy to pay their share of deficit reduction as a surtax on millionaires would. The surtax was in the original House budget plan, but the White House refused to accept it. Tonight, House and Senate negotiators will finalize the details of this new compromise, and the leadership says it expects to have something on the floor of both houses within the next 2 days. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
Secretary of State James Baker and Defense Secretary Dick Cheney briefed Congress today on the situation in the Persian Gulf. As NPR's Ann Garrels reports, this may be their last briefing before Congress adjourns.
Members of Congress said the secretaries didn't break any new ground and they had no clearer picture of what might happen before they come back early next year. But everyone agreed it was important Congress had been briefed. However, Secretary of State Baker would still not promise Congress it would be advised before any military action. Secretary of Defense Cheney was pressed on the number of troops to be sent, but he said, "We've never put an upper limit, and I just don't know the answer." Cheney said he's looking at ways to rotate troops, and he suggested the 82nd Airborne Division might be replaced. Cheney said he's satisfied he now has a range of options available to the president. He told reporters he sees no evidence Iraqi President Saddam Hussein is contemplating a withdrawal from Kuwait. I'm Ann Garrels at the Capitol.
Former Pakistani Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto has apparently won a seat in parliament despite the overwhelming defeat of her party. Bhutto, who was ousted from power in August, charged that the caretaker government of President Ghulam Ishaq Khan had stolen the election with massive vote fraud. Early results showed Bhutto's Pakistan People's Party trailing badly behind the right-wing Islamic Democratic Alliance. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 10 points today to close at 2,504.21. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Dilip Hero, has written about the underlying causes of the current Gulf crisis. His books include Inside the Middle East, Holy Wars, The Rise of Islamic Fundamentalism, and a forthcoming book on the Iran-Iraq War called The Longest War. He's also written articles for The Wall Street Journal, The Nation, and The New York Times. Hero is an Indian-born journalist who lives in London. He joins us from the NPR bureau there. Hero says that understanding the Iran-Iraq war is essential to understanding what's happening today in the Gulf.
When Saddam Hussein attacked Iran, he had about 250,000 soldiers in his army. By the time he finished 8 years later on, he had 1.25 million soldiers in his army. And that is the starting point of the current crisis. If Saddam Hussein would not be as strong as he became in the course of the 8-year-long war with Iran, we would not have this crisis now. How he came to become so powerful, that, of course, is the story of the Iran-Iraq war. He was bankrolled by the Saudis and the Kuwaitis. He had his weapons from the Soviet Union and also from France. And, of course, he got plenty of intelligence reports from America through Saudi Arabia and later on directly. And, of course, we know that in the summer of 1987, U.S. Navy moved into the Persian Gulf, basically on the side of Saddam Hussein. So unless we understand how Saddam Hussein came to be as strong as he is today and how he got there, I don't think we can make sense of what's happening now.
You say that the Iran-Iraq war was primarily about the struggle between secular Arab nationalism, as represented by Iraq, and the Islamic Revolution, as represented by Iran. Can you elaborate on what each country represented in that struggle?
Yes, absolutely. I think, you know, the rise of the Islamic Revolution and its success in Iran is a totally unprecedented phenomenon. The whole point about the politics of the world, of this World War II, have been essentially class-level Marxist revolutions on one hand and capitalist camp led by America on the other hand as the force of status quo. Whereas in Iran, what happened, it had very little to do with class. So here we had a revolution, but we did not have a classical Marxist revolution, and that was the confusion. And when something like this happened, nobody, either in the Soviet Union or in the American camp, understood what was going on, and they knew that Iran went out of the Western orbit, but it did not go to the Soviets. But even then, there was such hostility towards Iran that all kinds of efforts were made to overthrow that particular regime, because all the countries around Iran are Muslim countries. They had their problems and they could be sucked into by this particular ideology. And because this happened in the Persian Gulf region, which has two-thirds of the world's oil resources, therefore, the American objective was to stop Khomeini, possibly overthrow him. And Saddam Hussein and Iraq had their own reasons to confront Khomeini, because Saddam Hussein and the Ba'ath Party are secular socialist. And also, in Iraq itself, 55% of the Iraqi nationals are Shiite. And Khomeini was a Shiite leader. Therefore, Saddam Hussein became extremely nervous that his own Iraqi Shiites, inspired by Khomeini and by the Islamic Revolution of Iran, would topple him, would have an uprising which would result in his overthrow. So he had his own reasons to attack Iran, but he was encouraged by America through the Saudi ruling family, and that's why he attacked Iran in September 1980.
My guest is Dilip Hero, and he's a Pakistani-born British journalist who covers Middle East affairs, and he has a new book coming out on the Iran-Iraq War called The Longest War. Do you think that Saddam, by the end of the Iran-Iraq War, had managed to contain Islamic fundamentalism?
Absolutely. You see, if you take the course of the war, the first 2 years of the war, things were going well for the Iraqis. And the Iranians were on the defensive. But within 2 years of the war, Iran had expelled the Iraqis from their territory. And after that, there were two possibilities. Either Iran was going to win, or there was going to be a stalemate. And that stalemate went on for several years. And that's when the Western powers, and America particularly, moved in to practically back up materially, as well as in terms of intelligence, as well as in terms of giving credit to the Iraqi government to buy cheap food grains. This started, incidentally, in 1983. So all efforts were put in, both material, diplomatic, military, and political, to make sure that Saddam Hussein does not go down, that he is able to withstand the offensives that the Iranians were launching constantly. And finally, he succeeded. Finally, Saddam Hussein expelled the Iranians from the territories they had occupied. He used chemical weapons on an extensive basis, but neither USA nor the USSR took any action against Saddam Hussein when he used chemical weapons against the Iranians on a very large scale. And that basically stopped Khomeini and his any plans for export of the Islamic Revolution. And to that extent, he served the purpose, the main objective of the Western powers. He served the purpose of the Saudis and Kuwaitis. Because if Iran had won, two things would have happened. One, the oil price would have gone up. And two, the oil sheikhs, the oil monarchs in the six Gulf states would have been overthrown. And now we find 2 years after Saddam was able to stop Khomeini, Saddam Hussein is doing exactly what Khomeini wanted to do, i.e. raise the oil price, and of course he disposed of the ruler of Kuwait, maybe as a start.
Now, Khomeini wanted to get rid of the monarchs in the Gulf states because Khomeini didn't believe in monarchy or an inherited power. What were Saddam's reasons for turning against the Saudis and Kuwait, who had been his allies during the Iran-Iraq war?
Yeah, that's quite true. I think, one has to therefore go back to the ideology of Arab Baath Socialist Party. Arab Baath Socialist Party is a Republican party. It's a secular party. It is a socialist party with a very strong public sector in the economy of the countries which they run. Therefore, ideologically, Baathism is against having monarchs. And forget about what the monarchs, what Saddam Hussein thinks about them or what Khomeini thinks about them. You look at the real situation at the ground. There is Saudi Arabia. Now, this country with 25% of the world oil reserves does not have a written constitution. Can you believe that? It's a fact. It has no constitution at all. Now, these monarchies are run as autocracies, completely at the whim of one person. And that is the weakness of the whole system.
Why do you think the United States is supporting monarchies in the Gulf and not trying to push them toward democratization?
Yeah, well, I think the question is very simple. Because when you have got six ruling families controlling 44% of the world oil reserves, it's much simpler to deal with six ruling families. If you have a democratic system, if tomorrow you have political parties, have elections in Saudi Arabia or in Oman or in UAE, etc., then there will be different viewpoints which will come up. And these viewpoints may be, some of them may be anti-American, some of them may be neutral towards America, some of them may be pro-American. Now, if you open up the system, the chances are that the representative government or a popular government which comes through the electoral process may at best be neutral towards America, and at worst it could be against America. So the best thing is to keep this tight monopolistic system, because you can always maneuver six ruling families than having to deal with maybe 600 politicians in this part of the world. There so you're much better off keeping things as they are. Now, when I'm talking about this kind of scenario, I'm not speculating. Look at Jordan. In Jordan, which is a monarchy, it doesn't have oil, but it's a monarchy. They had elections last November. First free and fair elections in at least 23 years. You know the result of the election? 40% of the 80 MPs, members of parliament, are Islamic fundamentalists. You have that situation. Plus you've got at least half of the population which is Palestinian. Now, therefore, the King Hussein of Jordan, if he has to reflect the true feelings of his own people, he simply cannot go along with the USA, as he used to do before November 1989 election. That's why the USA is not pressurizing these countries to go for democratic system and elections.
Do you think Saddam Hussein is now more of a force for Arab nationalism or more of a force just for the power of Saddam Hussein?
I think Saddam Hussein has moved in at a time when there was a political vacuum. If you take an overall view of the situation, you know, in March 1979, Egypt was seduced out of the Arab ranks and it signed a peace treaty with Israel. Therefore, the Arab League were Egypt has been a traditional and historic leader of the Arab League, was lost to the Arabs. In that leadership vacuum, Saddam Hussein started a war with Iran in 1980. So in those 10 years that have gone by, Saddam Hussein has become the one single strong Arab military force with 1 million standing army, with a very powerful industrial military complex, its own production of weapons and chemical weapons and so on. So you got a strong Arab power in Iraq on one hand. Secondly, we have to see the running problem of the Palestinian-Israeli problem. And as you know, in November 1988, Yasser Arafat of the PLO openly denounced terrorism. He accepted Israel as a living entity, etc., etc. Despite that, the Americans, you know, they gave a concession of low-level talks with the PLO at Tunis, and even that was stopped in May of this year. So you got a political vacuum where the Palestinians have nowhere to go. They have given away all their cards. No progress was made. And there was a lot of anti-American feeling generally in the whole region. And that particular vacuum moved in Saddam Hussein. So it isn't the question whether Saddam Hussein is doing things for himself or he's a megalomaniac or whether he's a Hitler. That's not the point. The point is to understand political phenomenon at the ground level. So in that situation, Iraq has emerged as the number one political military leader of the Arab world, and it has got the sympathy of the Arabs generally because of the way the Americans have been behaving on the Palestinian issue.
I want to talk with you more about the current Gulf crisis, but first we have to take a short break. And my guest is Dilip Hero, and he's a journalist who covers Middle East affairs. He has a new book coming out on the Iran-Iraq war. It's called The Longest War. He's also written books on Islamic fundamentalism, books called Holy Wars and Iran Under the Ayatollahs. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Journalist Dilip Hero is my guest, and he's joining us from the National Public Radio Bureau in London. Mr. Hero, do you think that war is inevitable in the Gulf?
Not really. Because the longer there is no war, then the chances are there will be no war at all. Because if the Americans had moved in to undertake what is often talked about as surgical strikes, in the early days, the first 10 or 15 days, that would have been probably okay. Okay means the cost to America and others would have been much less. But by now, what's happened is that the hawks and even the doves and people in the Western capitals have done their homework. They have done their sums. And this is what they're looking at. If the shooting war starts, there will be at least 100,000 people dead. And of course, at least another 300,000 people injured. Now, out of the 100,000 people dead, at least one third of those people would be Americans and Europeans. Now, the European and the American governments have to ask the question, will their public accept this? That's one. Secondly, if the war starts, we are looking at oil selling at $100 a barrel. Now, the question is, can the Western economies, including Japan, withstand that kind of a shock? The third point we have to understand is that those countries, which Arab countries, which have gone along with the America, if the shooting war starts and if Arabs, that's Iraqi Arabs, are killed in their hundreds by American bombs and air strikes, the atmosphere in the Arab countries will change overnight. And I mean overnight. And there will be demonstrations in Cairo and in Morocco and possibly even Saudi Arabia, because their pull of the blood relationship with Arabs, their fellow Arabs, that will really overpower any other consideration. Therefore, the diplomatic consequences of a war, a shooting war, would be destabilization of those regimes which are backing America. And that's the third consideration. Now, therefore, if the Western powers look at the scenario of the shooting war, they have to ask themselves, are they prepared to accept that kind of a cost? And I think the more days and weeks have gone by, the conclusion seems to be more and more people are talking about, let's have a peaceful settlement.
And yet, the American press has been reporting that the Bush administration is afraid of compromise, that compromise is the nightmare scenario. What do you think a compromise would mean for Bush?
Yeah, okay. I think
and for America.
Yes, absolutely. I think question one has to ask is compromise, what kind of a compromise? Of course, if you take the Western position on compromise, it is not as uncompromising as it might appear. François Mitterrand, the French president, whose country is a permanent member of the Security Council, said at the UN General Assembly recently that he would favor a four-point plan, and the first point of the plan is that Saddam Hussein has simply to say, I will withdraw from Kuwait, and then other things are possible, including international conference on the Palestinian-Israeli problem, etc., etc. Even President Bush himself has said that once the Gulf crisis is settled, then we can look at the Arab-Israeli relationship and so on. So I don't think that the Western position is as uncompromising as it appears, or as, you know, the media would have it. That's one. Secondly, and very importantly, you know, quite honestly, it isn't up to Mr. President Bush to go into Kuwait or go into Iraq. It is up to a gentleman who is the king of Saudi Arabia, that is King Fahad. Only when King Fahad say, okay, you can use my land to launch this particular offensive, then only the thing can start. Now, then we go back to what I can only call a cultural pattern of behavior amongst Arabs. Now, if the Kuwaiti ruler and the Iraqi ruler have an understanding, which they may reach behind the scenes, that, okay, I will get out, but when I get out, or soon after, you are going to lease these two offshore islands to me, and you are going to have, we are going to have a border which gives me all of the oil fields on the border. It's quite possible. In fact, such talks are going on all the time. And therefore, one must not put away and take seriously what the leader writers in American press are saying, etc., etc. You have ultimately to return to the Arabs, to the people who live in the Gulf, people who own 66% of the world oil reserves. That's where you have to go to. And don't be surprised if some kind of a deal is cut between the Arab leaders, you know, of course, through diplomacy, and diplomacy is always very quiet and very secretive, if that comes about.
Say a compromise is reached where Iraq withdraws from Kuwait but maintains control over the two Kuwaiti islands and the oil field that straddles Iraq and the Iraq and Kuwaiti border. How much power do you think Saddam would then have? It would have been a compromise, but he wouldn't have totally lost power, which, you know, seems to be the goal of some of the Western countries here. So how much power do you think he'd have left if there was a compromise? What kind of force would he be in the Gulf?
Yeah, I think this is the key point. You know, in the early days, there was so much talk about taking out Saddam Hussein, destroying his regime, and his assassination, which was openly talked about, and his regime should be undermined by the CIA. President Bush openly said that. I think since then, President Bush has been advised by, among others, Mrs. Thatcher, British Prime Minister, who is no friend of Saddam Hussein, that you should be very careful. We are talking of international law. And in international law, no law says that you should have a particular regime within a country. If Saddam Hussein is a dictator, he runs his country. Well, there are many dictatorships in the world. Okay, so we had to be careful. And I think President Bush has understood this. And he has calmed down on that point about taking out Saddam Hussein's regime, etc., etc. So that's one point. Secondly, if Saddam Hussein were to survive this regime, how is he going to appear to his own people? Of course, he's made umpteen statements that Kuwait is our land forever and ever. But at the end of all this thing, if this is going to be no shooting war, Saddam Hussein will be able to say to his people, I got two offshore islands. They may be leased for 99 years. It's a long time. That means I have a much greater access to the Gulf. Therefore, Iraq is much better, a truly Gulf state than before, one. Secondly, the Palestinian problem, which had been put on the back burner and Palestinians had no cards to play, I have revived that particular thing. It is on the world agenda and things are moving on that front. So once he has done that, then if he withdraws, he will be able to say, I have achieved something. Now the third point, whether having Saddam Hussein with 1 million standing army is a destabilizing factor by itself, that needs to be addressed in the fashion like there should be a Gulf regional security arrangement. And you see, you know, at present there is something called Gulf Cooperation Council, GCC, which has all the six monarchies. They set it up in 1981. Now, if this crisis ends with through peaceful means, then I think it will be interest of everybody, including the countries in the Gulf, to enlarge the Gulf Cooperation Council to take in both Iran and Iraq. If Iraq were to become a part of this eight-nation cooperation council, then I think, you know, Iraq could be controlled. You know, it could be brought into a network of security arrangements, and that may be a solution to the problem. But once again, we must return to the two major problems, which are the Palestinian-Israeli problem, one. Secondly, the ownership of oil. We cannot have a system whereby 44% of the world oil reserve is controlled by six families who treat this as their personal property. That is such a destabilizing factor that if it is not Khomeini today, and if it's not Khomeini yesterday, if it's not Saddam Hussein today, somebody else tomorrow will go and attack these monarchs and create another crisis.
So you're saying that if Saddam stays in power, it will have to be the Arab countries, the Gulf countries, that control that power. It won't be the Western countries that could really accomplish that.
Yes, absolutely. I think Saddam Hussein's, you know, military-industrial complex has gone to that point where I don't think it can be destroyed. Secondly, you must remember that Arabs themselves feel that the only country which can stand up to Israel, and we have to accept the fact of life for Arabs, is that Israel is an enemy country. And the only country which can stand up to Israel singly or jointly is Iraq. Now, in terms of the regional situation, where, you see, Iraq can be balanced by the Iranians, you know, and that's when I'm talking about a joint Gulf Cooperation Council in which both Iran and Iraq are members.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
My guest has been Dilip Hero, and he is an Indian-born British journalist who covers Middle East affairs. He has a new book coming out on the Iran-Iraq War called The Longest War, and I'll spell his name for you. It's Dilip Hiro. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Sleep with Anger is a new film starring Danny Glover as a drifter who shows up at the home of old friends and creates havoc in their middle-class family. Coming up, director Charles Burnett on making a movie by and about blacks that challenges the Hollywood assumption that black films are either action films or Spike Lee films. Also, rock historian Ed Ward picks up the story of soul singer, songwriter, and producer Curtis Mayfield. And Maureen Corrigan reviews a new book about the heroines of 1930s Hollywood comedies. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Saying its decision is based on principle, Israel has turned down a new appeal by President Bush to permit UN investigators to look into the slaying of 21 Palestinians. This rejection sets the stage for a U.S. vote against Israel in the U.N. Security Council. Barry Schwide reports.
The president's letter, delivered to Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir yesterday, requested a change in the Israeli decision. The president said that would help switch the focus at the U.N. back to Iraq and its occupation of Kuwait. But Israeli officials told U.S. diplomats in Jerusalem and in Washington that the U.N. had already decided to condemn Israel and that, besides, the inquiry posed a challenge to Israeli sovereignty over Jerusalem. As a result, U.S. diplomats at the U.N. informed other members of the Security Council that the U.S. would support a new resolution deploring Israel's refusal to admit the U.N. investigators. As a result, the rift between Washington and Jerusalem widened some more. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schwide at the State Department.
And the State Department says that embassy personnel at the U.S. Embassy in Kuwait have dug a shallow well in the backyard of the embassy compound and have thus been able to conserve water. Iraqi occupation forces shut off water at all embassies in Kuwait 2 months ago, and the U.S. embassy is one of the few still open. The backyard well has supplied water for baths and washing clothes and allowed the embassy to conserve its drinking water. In Washington, President Bush has accepted the resignation of his Labor Secretary Elizabeth Dole, who will become the new president of the American Red Cross. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
Mr. Bush said it was with real deep regret that he accepted the resignation of the highest-ranking woman in his administration. The president said that during Mrs. Dole's 25 years in public service, she has earned the respect of the American people.
And as Secretary of Labor, she's made the workplace safer, healthier, and more secure. And she's reached out to Americans on the job, youth at risk, workers in retirement.
Dole said she was leaving the cabinet in order to take advantage of a now-or-never opportunity to run the American Red Cross. She denied that her departure signals a desire to run for public office. I'm Richard Gonzalez at the White House.
On Capitol Hill, by a single vote, the U.S. Senate upheld the president's veto of the major civil rights bill of 1990. The Senate vote was 66 to 34, one vote short of the necessary two-thirds needed to override. The president has vetoed 16 bills, and Congress has failed to override any of them. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up 10 points to close at 2,504.21 on volume of some 150 million shares. Advancing issues led declines by a slight margin. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Coming up, I'll talk with filmmaker Charles Burnett about his new movie, To Sleep With Anger. Soul singer Curtis Mayfield was beginning an American comeback tour over the summer when stage lights fell on him and left him paralyzed from the neck down. Last week, rock and roll historian Ed Ward began his two-part tribute to Mayfield. Ed says that back in the early 60s, Columbia Records knew if it wanted any part of the growing black record market, they needed to stockpile talent to fight off Motown's big edge.
To counter Motown, Columbia Records looked to Chicago and revived an old name, O.K. They put Carl Davis, a savvy producer who'd hit with Gene Chandler's Duke of Earl, in charge. Davis then went out and hired songwriter Curtis Mayfield and a jazz bassist named Johnny Pate to produce and arrange for O.K. Mayfield was still having success with his own group, The Impressions, but he was writing more songs than they could use, and anyway, he had a battle plan for them. OK's first artist was Major Lance, an ex-boxer whose first OK record, Delilah, had hardly made a dent. Johnny Pate stepped in to arrange the second one, and voila, a hit.
There's a place right across town, whenever you're ready. While people
The Monkey Time was a top 10 pop smash, and it put OK square on the map. Following Motown's example, OK concentrated on a small number of talented artists. Mayfield had started singing with Jerry Butler and knew that Jerry's brother Billy had a group, Billy Butler and the Enchanters. And he also found great new voices out there, too, like Walter Jackson.
Mama said there ain't gonna be any roses popping up.
But there was a problem with Jackson. He'd had polio as a child, and he performed on crutches, something that was unlikely to be a hit with teenagers. OK had a problem, too. This was still the era of regional hits, and OK had no trouble coming up with them, but they remained regional. The vast majority of the superb work Mayfield, Pate, and Davis were doing remained a Midwestern phenomenon. Curtis Mayfield knew that, thanks to their reputation, there was no such problem with the Impressions, and furthermore, he was writing songs for them that reflected his most personal concerns, concerns that were making headlines in 1964, but weren't making the charts.
Keep on pushing, I've got to keep on pushing, I can't stop now. Somehow, 'cause I've got my strength, and it don't make sense not to keep on pushing.
Without being overtly influenced by Bob Dylan, like so many other performers, black and white, at this time, Curtis Mayfield began to provide a soundtrack for the civil rights movement that drew from the same sources that Martin Luther King's did, the church. First with Keep On Pushin', then with Amen, and then with this masterpiece, the Impressions delivered something nobody else did.
People get ready, there's a train a-coming. You don't need no baggage, you just get on board. All you need is faith to hear the dealers honing. Don't need no chicken. You just thank the Lord.
By 1966, it was becoming evident that OK wasn't going to do as much for him as he could do for himself. So Curtis Mayfield put all of the energy that he wasn't using for the Impressions into his own label, Windy Sea. It was a disaster. Undaunted, he formed Mayfield Records and watched it, too, fall apart. He could still summon up optimism for the Impressions, and in 1968, he delivered his last great social consciousness song, We're a Winner.
We're a winner, and never let anybody say, well, you can't make it, 'cause some people mind is in your way. No more tears do we cry, and we have finally dried our eyes, and we're moving on up, moving on up. Lord have mercy, we're moving on up.
It would be his last hurrah for a while. In 1970, Curtis quit the Impressions to concentrate on a solo career and his Kurtom production company. His music was getting eccentric, featuring guitar and congas and little else. Still, in 1972, Mayfield showed he had what it took by scoring two top 10 hits from the score he'd written for the film Superfly.
Darkest of night with the moon shining bright, there's a set going strong, a lot of things going on.
man of the hour has an air of great power. The dudes have envied him for so long. Oh, Superfly, you're gonna make your fortune by and by. But if you lose, don't ask no questions why. The only game you know is do or die. Hard to understand.
But that was it. Curtis had gotten too weird for American taste, although he continued to record, and some of what he recorded was quite good. His recent accident that's left him paralyzed has brought him back to the spotlight, so I suppose some reassessment of his work will finally come to pass. I hope so. This has only skimmed the surface of the contributions of Curtis Mayfield.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll, and he writes for the Austin Chronicle. This is Fresh Air. Danny Glover has reached movie star status, but his latest role is in an independent film by my guest Charles Burnett, a writer and director who until now was only known on the film festival circuit. Burnett's new film, To Sleep With Anger, is about three generations of a middle-class black family living in Los Angeles. The grandparents migrated to L.A. from the South. An old friend from the South, a drifter named Harry Minchin, shows up at their door and they invite him to stay. But he creates havoc in the family, trying to encourage their most hedonistic and selfish impulses. Danny Glover plays the drifter Harry Minchin. In this scene, he's at the family's house, meeting another old friend who he hasn't seen since she left the South decades ago.
Girl, you still sing and dance?
Oh, no, Harry. I'm a different person now.
Haven't the years been good to Hattie? It hasn't been the years. It's been the men in her life.
Harry, that's not nice. I'm in church now.
Why go run and close the barn when the horse is gone? I remember when you weren't saved. That was way back when the Natchez Trace was just a dirt road.
Some people grow up and change their ways.
You've described the Harry Minchin character as a folkloric character. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, in a sense that it was sort of based on a character that comes out of a Georgian folktale, and it's and the trickster's name is Harry Man, and he comes in different disguises, and he ends up stealing your soul if you're not clever enough. And the thing is to outsmart him once you've captured by him.
And how did you learn about the trickster?
Well, I don't think one sort of learns in a sense that it's conscious. It's something that sort of, it's a part of you. You know, you sort of grow up and it's just there. It's in your environment. It's in your culture in a sense. And because I was born in Vicksburg, Mississippi, right? But I grew up in Los Angeles. And in the 40s and 50s, most people were from this, just about everyone was from the South, Louisiana, Alabama, Mississippi, Arkansas, and so you had that Southern culture there. And now it's no longer exists the same way it did then. You know, it's probably a great deal less, and that's the reason why I made the film, actually.
What did the South mean to you when you were growing up? Did your parents tell you stories about the South? Did it feel like the old country to you in a lot of ways?
Well, yeah, in a way, it was a sort of mythical land in a sense, you know, because you hear, you know, you heard about all these problems and, you know, race problems and so forth. You know, you were just taught basically how to relate in the world, you know, this whole thing about saying yes sir, no sir, you know, because there was this, I guess, feeling that, you know, because we had a lot of relatives and friends back home, so to speak, that we were going to go back. So my grandmother particularly was sort of preoccupied with trying to train us on how to act, you know. And because when we did go back, we would, you know, it was very critical that we, you know, knew what was going on in the South and how to cope with it, you know.
What were some of the things that your grandmother taught you ways she taught you to behave when you went back to the cell.
Well, it's sort of it's sort of embarrassing in a way. You know, there's things you want to forget, you know, in a certain sense. You know, it's just that, well, for example, my brother was he's sort of, he grew up in L.A. He knew nothing about the South except what my mother, grandmother and mother told him. And so the big concern was if he goes back, you know, what we're going to do about him. Because, you know, he was sort of rebellious. You know, he wasn't going to say yes sir and no sir to a white person or get off the street or react in a certain way, you know. He's the kind of person who's going to speak his mind, you know. And so that was a big concern, you know. So it was a sort of drill. Because when we were back in 57, you know, it was a big concern about, you know, whether we should take this boy back to Mississippi and show him his relatives and all this sort of thing. And, you know, it's that sort of thing.
There's a lot of superstitions in your movie, superstitions that the older generation from the South brought with them to the North. Good luck charms, fears of, you know, like that... If a broom touches your feet, it's bad luck. Were you exposed to a lot of that when you were growing up? Superstitions that you didn't understand that were from a different part of the culture?
Yeah, that touching with a broom thing is very serious because, you know, some people get very violent when you touch them with a broom, you know. And I think that's one of the things you really had to learn and understand very quickly because people had very strong superstitions because usually... For some people, if you touch them with a broom, that means they're going to jail. So the funny part was, and when I was a kid, a lot of those things, I never, you were busy in your own world, you know, trying to create your own world. And these people had their old ways. And, you know, it was like the blues they were forcing on you and all these other things, you know. And rock and roll was a thing. And, you know, it was just a different world. And those old superstitions and things just didn't fit in, you know.
So were there a lot of cultural things that you were exposed to when you were growing up that you wanted to separate yourself from that ended up in this movie now and that you feel differently toward now?
Well, yes. I mean, I think my whole approach toward making film is a product of trying to rediscover, in a sense, those things that I've grown to miss over the years. I didn't realize how important they were until somehow or another you arrive at a point and realize there's a vacuum in your life, and you look around and you say, yeah, it's because, you know, these things aren't a part of your life anymore, and you feel that these kids that are growing up now don't have an experience, a sort of rich environment, cultural things that you're able to fall back on, you know.
I think that Hollywood believes now that there really is an important film-going black audience and that the black dollar really counts, you know what I mean, in terms of movie making. On the other hand, I think that they think of the black film audience as being mostly teenagers who are interested in action movies or maybe in Spike Lee's latest movie. Mm-hmm. But your movie is... It's a quiet movie. Do you know what I mean? It's a character study. It's an intergenerational movie. There's not rap music in it. I wonder if that makes it harder to get a movie backed. You know, a movie backed that has a black cast and is made by a black filmmaker.
Yeah, it was very difficult, and that was all those points you mentioned were the things that were brought out when we were trying to find financing for it. You know, because it didn't fit into any of those categories. And even now, there's still some concern about trying to get this black audience that doesn't go to the movies anymore out to support the film. And so it's still a big concern.
Where does the title of your film, To Sleep With Anger, come from?
Well, it's a biblical expression in a sense. It's not quite... quote it properly. It's somewhere in I can't remember what passage now, where it says, don't take your troubles to bed or don't go to bed in anger or something like that, you know. And I just remembered the idea, and so I took that idea and worded it to what's the name of the movie? Don't Sleep in Anger. God, I don't even know my own movies now. What is the name?
To Sleep With Anger, yeah.
Yeah, To Sleep With Anger.
Did you really forget the title of your film?
I really did. I mean, the reason is because there was so much talk about changing the title of it, you know? And the funny part is that everyone always asked me that question, and I formed a block or something in the middle. and I honestly, every question, every time I screen the film, two questions always pop up. What was the end of the joke that Gideon tells, and what's the title mean, and where did you get the title? And To Sleep With Angers, I mean, you answer it so many times until, you know, you be it's just not there anymore, you know?
So who wanted to change the title?
Well, there was some discussion after Cannes about changing the title because there was a review written in one of the trades about how that the title perhaps doesn't really reflect what the film is about, or because they felt that the title sort of suggests an angrier film, you know. And the person who saw it said no, they thought that the film was not angry at all, you know. In my view, the title never did mean angry, or angry never suggested that. It just suggested that, in a sense, that there's all these people with all these pent-up frustrations and unresolved conflicts, you know, that over the years it created this sort of distorted view of life, like Harry, for example, you know. And the idea is that you have to release all those things, all those problems, or resolve them, in a sense.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you for inviting me here.
Charles Burnett wrote and directed the new film To Sleep With Anger.
Lord, when you get home, baby, please write me a few of your lines. So now you write me a few of your lines. Lord, that'll be consolation. Lord, mama, to my worried mind.
This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us to let us know what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. NPR's Alan Tomlinson talks with some of the British hostages released just recently from Iraq. In Pakistan, the people are voting for a new prime minister, and Benazir Bhutto is now charging that the voting was rigged, the ballot boxes have been stuffed, and she is conceding that election under protest. Brian Naylor reports from Israel on new restrictions for Palestinians in the occupied territories. A report from Yosemite National Park on the question of development in the valley. How much more comfortable should the park be made for tourists? And also a vote at a high school in Maryland on the Eastern Shore. Condoms will not be made available to students.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Back in the 1930s, maverick film directors like Frank Capra, George Stevens, and Preston Sturges unleashed the comic talents of actresses like Myrna Loy, Barbara Stanwyck, and Katharine Hepburn. A new book by Elizabeth Kendall, The Runaway Bride, focuses on these movie heroines. Critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
After reading The Runaway Bride, I want to lock myself in my apartment for a week, just me and the VCR, and watch all those buoyant romantic comedies of the 30s. Movies like It Happened One Night, My Man Godfrey, and Stage Door. No, better yet, I don't want to just watch those movies. I want to live in them. I'd like to be Ginger Rogers in Swing Time. She plays a platinum blonde working girl who lures Fred Astaire away from his high society sweetheart. This may be a reactionary plot for a feminist to admire, but compare it to this summer's most popular working girl movie, Pretty Woman. Julia Roberts' hooker needs a millionaire to rescue her, but Ginger Rogers' hoofer rescues Astaire from a life of empty luxury. In the book, The Runaway Bride, Elizabeth Kendall says that the Rogers character wasn't a fluke.
During the 30s, Hollywood discovered that pretty women could also be smart and funny and self-respecting. This new proto-feminist heroine was a response to the Depression, when people needed tougher role models. Most of these romantic comedies also contained a populist political message. On-screen couples often came from different class backgrounds, but romantic love always triumphed over wealth. The Runaway Bride interprets 30s movies with all the subtlety and wit that made those movies so great. And according to Kendall, the greatest of them all was the 1934 comedy, It Happened One Night. Claudette Colbert plays an heiress who flees her own wedding. She's the runaway bride of the book's title. She hops aboard a bus and meets Clark Gable, an out-of-work reporter. Sparks fly as Colbert asserts herself, and Gable finds the competition provocative. Here's some romantic sparring from the famous hitchhiking scene.
Here comes a car.
Okay, now watch me. I'm going to use number one. Keep your eye on that thumb, baby, and see what happens.
I stood up my eye on the thumb.
Something must have gone wrong.
Oh.
Try number two.
Mm. Well, when you get to 100, wake me up. Do you mind if I try?
You? Don't make me laugh.
Oh, you're such a smart aleck. Nobody knows anything but you. I'll stop a car, and I won't use my thumb.
What are you going to do?
It's a system all my own.
Gable's rational male methods for bumming a ride can't compete with Colbert's potent flash of leg. At movie's end, they run off together, the perfect romantic comedy couple, equally matched in humor, guts, and sex appeal. But by the 40s, romantic comedy was dying. Love farces seemed too impudent for wartime. Kendall says that even those Tracy Hepburn movies of the 40s that we always think of as being so liberated were actually a throwback. Hepburn, after all, always ends up learning humility and other wifely virtues. The feisty heroines of the 30s faded into weepy victims, bad girls, and nasty career women. And lately, it seems to have gotten even worse. You'd think that after more than 20 years of feminism, our movie heroines would be doing something else besides waiting around to be saved by corporate raiders or ghosts.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. Amy Salad and Phyllis Myers produce the interviews on Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs. 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the editor of The Nation, Victor Novasky, talks with us about his magazine's 125 years of dissenting opinion. Also, we meet Guatemala novelist Arturo Arias. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.